Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The world isn't run by weapons anymore, or energy, or money. It's run by little ones and zeros, little bits of data. It's all just electrons.
There's a war out there, old friend. A world war. And it's not about who's got the most bullets. It's about who controls the information. What we see and hear, how we work, what we think. It's all about the information.
That was Ben Kingsley in the 1992 movie Sneakers. Maybe you haven't seen it. But one person who did was Mike McConnell, the NSA director from 92 to 96. And he's one of many individuals featured in a new book by Slate's War Stories columnist Fred Kaplan. The book is Dark Territory, The Secret History of Cyber War, published by Simon & Schuster. And it's even more timely than it was going to be anyway because of the dispute between Apple and the government over how to handle encryption on the late San Bernardino shooter's phone. Hey, Fred, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So multiple times in the book, you write about the plausibility of cyber war scenarios as portrayed in movies like Sneakers and War Games. Is the world really run by little ones and zeros? And is it really all about who controls the information?
It's getting to seem that way, isn't it? I think bullets and bombs still have a pretty big impact, though. But you mentioned it's true. One thing that I discovered in doing the research for this is that so Mike McConnell, a veteran of Navy intelligence, comes in to direct the NSA. The Cold War is over. He's wondering, what does this giant organization do? What is its mission? And he goes to see Sneakers because somebody told him that it's about the NSA. And there is that scene, he stands up straight in his chair. He gets the final reel of the film and has every director, every person in the executive offices of the NSA watch that. He says, this is our mission statement. This is what we are about now. And all of a sudden, every military service has an office of information warfare. He hires one of the best people out on the field to be his director of information warfare. And the NSA had been doing things like this before, but it becomes a much more focused enterprise in a post-Cold War context.
You fantasize or speculate what a cyber Pearl Harbor might look like if it were to be launched in the U.S. What do you think it would?
Oh, boy. I really don't think that's how it would happen. When people in government started to think about this, and it was much longer ago than people to think. It was back in the 80s and then again in the 90s. They talked about a cyber Pearl Harbor where all of a sudden there is this attack on critical infrastructure. It was realized back in the 90s that critical infrastructure, meaning banking and finance, transportation, electrical power supplies, dams, things like that, they were increasingly being hooked up to computer networks for convenience, for economies of scale, with nobody doing this realizing that these networks were incredibly vulnerable to even pretty simple hacking. And so people anticipate, God, somebody on the other side of the world or just down the street could launch a devastating attack. They don't have to blow up the dam. They just have to electronically alter the computers controlling the flow of water in and out of the dams, and they could do incredible damage.
Do targeted cyber attacks like that ever have a moral advantage over dropping bombs or putting actual human beings at risk or into combat?
Well, you could say that. I mean, it is true that if you could disable a target by preventing information from going in and out of it, and then you don't have to blow it up and killing people inside – yeah, I guess you could say that. But, you know, at the same time, and we see this also with drone weapons, if you get into that mentality a bit too deeply, you can start kidding yourself that you're not really fighting a war, that you're not killing people. You're just stopping the flow of information.
Yeah. And you give an example of the book of an incident during the Gulf War where the NSA had eyes on an Iraqi power generator that was powering both their military and a local hospital. The U.S. could have launched a cyber attack on the generator, but they decided it would be unjust to kill those civilians in the hospital. And then the military decided to drop the old-fashioned bombs on the generator anyway. Right. What happened there?
Well, now, this was back in the Gulf War of 90 to 91. This was at a time when no senior official had even used a computer, much less had thought about this. Cyber war, the phrase didn't exist, and yet there was a lot going on, even in that war, using what we would now call cyber techniques. And, there was one incident where they said, okay, to do this feint of our troops, we need to turn off one of Saddam Hussein's warning systems and radar devices. And we can do this with computers, not bombs. And somebody said, well, what's the chance of this working? And they had to say in honesty that they didn't know what the chance is, because this was still very new. And it had to be done, and it had to be done like tomorrow for 12 hours. And so, you know, they played it conservative and went with the bomb.
Fred Kaplan, Slate's War Stories columnist, talking about the stories in his new book, Dark Territory, The Secret History of Cyber War. Now, since the deal with Iran over their nuclear weapons program is in the news, I want to go back and play a clip that you cite in the book of Sheldon Adelson, the casino owner and pro-Israel billionaire, speaking about the Iran deal at Yeshiva University when it was still in development in 2013.
What are we going to negotiate about? What I would say is, listen, you see that desert out there? I want to show you something. So you pick up your cell phone and you call somewhere in Nebraska and you say, okay, let it go. So there's an atomic weapon goes over ballistic missiles in middle of the desert that doesn't hurt a soul. Maybe a couple of rattlesnakes and scorpions or whatever. And then you say, see, the next one is in the middle of Tehran.
All right. Well, Sheldon Adelson being Sheldon Adelson. But you tell in the book a kind of freaky and remarkable story of what happened after that.
Yeah. Well, by that time, Iran had developed a cyber capability, in part as a response to the Stuxnet operation against Iran's nuclear facility. So they decided to launch a cyber attack on Sheldon Adelson's hotel casino chain, Las Vegas Sands. And they launched they spent weeks getting into his network, scoping it out, seeing the points of vulnerability, and they launched a devastating attack, shutting down all of their computers, getting into social security numbers, credit card numbers, and then planted on all of their screens a message saying, this is what happens when you talk about using weapons of mass destruction. Now, here's the curious thing. You hack into the networks of a casino, you could take a lot of money. There's a lot of money there. They didn't touch a dime. They were using this to issue a political statement, and this opened up a whole new phase of cyber warfare where you're not just going after trade secrets or military intelligence, things like this, but affecting political speech of your enemy. And, you know, more famously, a few months later, North Korea did the same thing, hacking into Sony for putting out the movie The Interview, which made fun of their dear leader. So a whole new dimension has opened up, not only of the kinds of powers that have this capability, but also the reasons that motivate them in putting it into action.
Listeners, any phone calls for Fred Kaplan on the secret history or perhaps the future of cyber war? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. In 1997, and again recently, the government-run exercises where a team of hackers, using only tools available to the lay consumer, invariably managed to hack into Defense Department networks. So is there a danger that we just won't be able to stay ahead of the threat?
Yeah. In fact, now the Pentagon at least acknowledges this. There was a Defense Science Board report came out a couple years ago. They talked about the inherent fragility of our networks. After decades of making improvements in detecting and guarding against these kinds of attacks, they've realized if somebody really wants to get into our networks, if it's a nation state in particular, there's nothing we can do about it. And therefore, the military and, you know, some private companies now as well are putting a big premium on what they call detection and resilience. In other words, they're going to get in. Make sure that you see very quickly when they do get in and make sure that you have the capability to repel them and then to clean up the damage very quickly afterwards.
Of the six presidential candidates still in the race, do any of them stand out to you as individuals with a grasp of cybersecurity or the threat that this possesses?
No. I would probably Secretary Clinton has been briefed about it most, but then again, she had a private email server, so she didn't take the briefings terribly seriously. It's a very secretive world. You know, and this has grown up within the province of the National Security Agency, which is the largest and one of the most secretive intelligence agencies in the nation. It was so secret that the joke back in the 60s and 70s was that NSA stands for No Such Agency. So all of these devices, all of the ideas behind them have grown up in intense secrecy, beyond top secret. People outside that community haven't really talked about it with any knowledge. People with a strategic bent haven't been able to weigh in until very, very recently. So this whole complex has grown up with no ideas about what does cyber deterrence mean? Nobody knows. What happens on the second day of a cyber attack, an exchange of attacks? It's never been gamed. I mean, this has been – people have been worried about this for 40 years, and yet we're still kind of in the same place we were with nuclear weapons in 1949.
Suzanne in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello?
Hi there.
Oh, hi. It's Suzanne. I'm one of the 26 million people whose data was taken in the OMB break-in, which includes, I will tell you, my birth certificate, my driver's license, my passport information, my fingerprints, what else? My school transcript from high school through grad school.
They're saying that was a Chinese attack.
And they are doing nothing except giving us monitoring. And for 18 months to look after that. And given all of that, why would we want our cell phone information in the hands of the government?
Well, here's the thing. The problem is there's really nothing we can do about this. You have your entire life networked now. Maybe somebody like the Unabomber living in a shack out in the middle of the forest, maybe he can go on. Maybe he can really get off the network. But it's all out there, and it's incredibly easy for somebody to hack into. Stuff like that, it doesn't even require a nation state. The good news is that in your case, probably nothing is going to happen to it. The theory is that it was the Chinese. They were looking for people with special kinds of clearances and maybe figuring out ways to contact them, ways to blackmail them or whatever. As long as you have a cable bill, a cell phone, a utility bill, you are out there and, there are things that you can do, very elementary things that, if what you're worried about is a common criminal or some punk in California just wants to hack into stuff for mischief, there are things you can do about that. If somebody who knows what he's doing or a nation state wants to come after your stuff for whatever reason, and I'm talking really high level stuff, there's almost nothing that you can do about it, I'm afraid.
Susie, good luck. It sounds like you may not have to pay too many consequences because you're probably not who they were looking for, let's hope. You said on the media last weekend, hosted by your wife, full disclosure, regarding the current dispute between the FBI and Apple over the phones belonging to the San Bernardino attackers, that it's really a red herring in the larger conversation about cybersecurity and personal privacy. Why so? And why, if so, why is it making so many headlines?
Well, because both sides in this fight, Apple and the government, are trying to elevate it into dealing with larger principles. This phone... remember the discussion about metadata during the Snowden affair? Metadata, the records of what numbers you've called and what numbers have called you.
Of course.
That's owned by the phone companies. That's already out there. They've already looked at that, and they've seen that there is no foreign number on this phone. If this were truly a matter of national security that we need to get into this phone right now, the NSA has ways of doing this which would not require Apple's cooperation. So basically, the FBI wants to create a precedent where they can expand their authorities into this sort of thing. And they see this as an easy case. Apple fought back. They want to limit the amount of information that the government can get. They want to make this a test case. And so that's – we're really talking about a much bigger argument, and both sides are seeing this. We're talking about either disrupting or preserving a very complicit arrangement between telecoms and the National Security Agency and law enforcement that's been going on decades, in fact, almost a century. But speaking of my wife, can I just say one thing?
That being Brooke Gladstone, for yes. Everybody who hasn't put two and two together, go ahead.
This Thursday at Community Bookstore in Brooklyn, she will actually be interviewing me about this book. We're not rehearsing anything. It's going to be a Nick and Nora kind of episode.
You probably rehearsed it over dinner for about 5 years. Yes. Let me sneak in one more call. Paul has, I think, a counterintuitive theory about security and Hillary Clinton's private server. Right, Paul?
Yes, correct.
Go ahead.
My question is it conceivable that because Hillary Clinton had her own private server, which was not well known by everybody else, that it was far more secure than government servers, which were hacked in? The CIA was hacked into. The IRS has been repeatedly hacked in. All kinds of Social Security numbers have been identified and brought forward. Is it conceivable that her server and her emails were far more secure than it would have been if it was on the government server?
No, because there were communications between her server and State Department servers. They've looked at the logs, and they have noticed attempts, probably by Russia, to hack into her phone. Kind of elementary stuff like phishing. You know, you get this all the time. You get an email which tempts you into clicking on a link, and then that downloads malware. She got a lot of things like that, but she didn't take the bait on any of them. Apart from that, there is no...
But they got into the OMB.
Yeah, that's how they got into that. I mean, the kind of security...
Into the government, meaning.
Yeah. No, it's amazing how unsecure a lot of these plans are. But no, there's... If they wanted... My guess is that there was nothing terribly important going on in her private email. A lot of things about CIA drone strikes, which are technically very classified, but that everybody knows about. But no, they would have been able to get in there.
And we have to leave it there with Fred Kaplan, author now of Dark Territory, The Secret History of Cyber War. Brooke is interviewing you where again?
At Community Bookstore Thursday night in Park Slope, 7 o'clock.
Fred, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.